You are listening to Talk Geek to Me News number 80, recorded for Wednesday, November the 7th, 2012. You are listening to the Tech Only Hacker Public Radio Edition. To get the full podcast, including political commentary and other controversial topics, please visit www.talkgeektome.us. Here are the vital statistics for this program. Your feedback matters to me. Please send your comments to dg@deepgeek.us. The webpage for this program is at www.talkgeektome.us. You can subscribe to me on Identica as the username DeepGeek, or you could follow me on Twitter. My username there is DGTGTM, as in Deep Geek, Talk Geek to Me. Before I start off the tech news, I want to announce that Talk Geek to Me news has to be cut back. It's just too time-consuming and my personal life is increasing. So, as a temporary setback, we'll be producing two shows per month at this point. The decision is not finalized. I did set up a straw poll at http://strawpoll.me/4866/, with some choices as to what I can do with the project. I hope you'll stop by, even if it's just to abstain from voting, so I know you've been there. However, I just have to produce less, and I also want to do other things. So, we're having at least a reduction to two shows a month instead of the normal three, and possibly a different permanent situation will emerge, but it will come as a last-minute reprise. I'm also interested if somebody would like to do a newscast once or twice a month. I am interested in hearing from you. I would be certainly glad to publish. And you might think, if you know of the world news section of the show, you might think that I might have a political requirement, but that's not the case. The only requirement I would have would be in regards to attribution and copyright rules. So if you're interested in becoming a unwaged newscaster, please contact me, and we can go from there. And now the tech roundup. From democracynow.org, Day 10-25, 2012. WikiLeaks releases trove of U.S. files on jailing foreign prisoners. In other WikiLeaks news, the whistleblowing group has just released a new cache of files detailing U.S. guidelines for jailing foreign prisoners at military prisons from Iraq to Guantanamo Bay. According to WikiLeaks, the detainee policies includes one manual instructing how to disappear prisoners into other government agencies while hiding their names from U.S. military records. From perspectives.mvdorona.com, dated Monday, October 29, 2012, by James Hamilton, AMD announces server-targeted ARM port. I have been interested in and writing about microservers since 2007. Microservers can be built using any instruction set architecture, but I'm particularly interested in ARM processors and their application to server-side workloads. Today, Advanced Micro Devices announced they are going to build an ARM CPU targeting the server market. This will be a 4-core, 64-bit, more than 2 GHz part that is expected to sample in 2013 and ship in volume in early 2014. AMD is far from new to the microserver market. In fact, much of my past work on microservers has been AMD-powered. What's different today is that AMD is applying their server processor skills, while at the same time leveraging the massive ARM processor ecosystem. ARM processors power Apple iPhones, Samsung smartphones, tablets, disk drives, and applications you didn't even know had computers in them. The defining characteristic of server processor selection is to focus first and most on raw CPU performance and accept the high cost and high power consumption that follows from that goal. The defining characteristics of microservers is we leverage the high-volume client and connected device ecosystems and make a CPU selection on the basis of a price performance and power performance with an emphasis on building balanced servers. The case for microservers is anchored upon these four observations. Volume economics. Rather than draw on the small volume economics of the server market, with microservers we leverage the massive volume economics of the smart device world driven by cell phones, tablets, and clients. To give some scale to this observation, IDC reports that there were 7.6 million server units sold in 2010. ARM reports that there were 6.1 billion ARM processors shipped last year. The connected and embedded device market volumes are 1,000 times larger than that of the server market, and the performance gap is shrinking rapidly. Semiconductor analysis Semicast estimates that by 2015, there will be 2 ARM processors for every person in the world. In 2010, ARM reported that on average there were 2.5 ARM-based processors in each smartphone. The connected and embedded device market is 1,000 times that of the server world. Having watched and participated in our industry for nearly 3 decades, one reality seems to dominate all others. High-volume economics drives innovation and just about always wins. As an example, IBM mainframes ran just about every important server-side workload in the mid-80s, but they were largely swept aside by higher-volume RISC servers running Unix. At the time, I loved RISC systems. Database systems would just scream on them, and they offered customers excellent price performance. But the same trend played out again. The higher-volume x86 processors from the client world swept the superior war-performing RISC systems aside. Invariably, what we see happening about once a decade is a high-volume, lower-priced technology takes over the low end of the market. When this happens, many engineers correctly point out that these systems can't hold a candle to the previous generation server technology, and then incorrectly believe they won't get replaced. The new generation is almost never better in absolute terms, but they are better price performers, so they first are adapted for the less performance-critical applications. Once this happens, the die is cast, and the outcome is just about assured. The high-volume parts move up the market and eventually take over even the most performance-critical workloads of the previous generation. We see the same scenario played out roughly once a decade. Not CPU-bound. Most discussion in our industry centers on the more demanding server workloads like databases, but in reality, many workloads are not pushing CPU limits and are instead storage, networking, and memory-bound. There are 2 major classes of workloads that don't need or can't fully utilize more CPU. Some workloads simply do not require the highest performing CPUs to achieve their SLAs. You can pay more and buy a higher performing processor, but it will achieve little for these applications. Some workloads just don't require more CPU performance to meet their goals. The second class of workloads is characterized by being blocked on networking, storage, or memory. And by memory bound, I don't mean the memory is too small. In this case, it isn't the size of the memory that is the problem, but the bandwidth. The processor looks to be fully utilized from an operating system perspective, but the bulk of its cycles are waiting for memory. Disk and CPU-bound systems are easy to detect by looking for which is running close to 100% utilization, while the CPU load is way lower. Memory-bound is more challenging to detect, but it's super common, so worth talking about. Most server processors are superscalar, which is to say they can retire multiple instructions each cycle. On many workloads, less than 1 instruction is retired each cycle. You can see this by monitoring instructions per cycle, because the processor is waiting for memory transfers. If a workload is bound on network, storage, or memory, spending more on a faster CPU will not deliver results. The same is true for non-demanding workloads. They too are not bound on CPU, so a faster part won't help in this case either. Price performance. Device price performance is far better than current generation server CPUs. Because there is less competition in the server processors, prices are far higher and price performance is relatively low compared to the device world. Using server parts, performance is excellent, but price is not. Let's use an example again. A server CPU is hundreds of dollars, sometimes approaching $1,000, whereas the ARM processor in an iPhone comes in at just under $15. My general rule of thumb in comparing ARM processors with server CPUs is that they are capable of 1/4 the processing rate at roughly 1/10 the cost. And super important, the massive shipping volume of the ARM ecosystem feeds the innovation and completion, and this performance gap shrinks the performance gap with each processor generation. Each generational improvement captures more possible server workloads, while further improving price performance. Power performance. Most modern servers run over 200 watts, and many are well over 500 watts, while microservers can weigh in at 10 to 20 watts. Nowhere is power performance more important than in portable devices, so the pace of power performance innovation in the ARM world is incredibly strong. In fact, I've long used mobile devices as a window into future innovations coming to the server market. The technologies you've seen in the current generation of cell phones has a very high probability of being used in a future server CPU generation. This is not the first ARM-based server processor that has been announced, and even more announcements are coming over the next year. In fact, that is one of the strengths of the ARM ecosystem. The R&D investments can be leveraged over huge shipping volume for many producers to bring more competition, lower cost, more choice, and faster pace of innovation. This is a good day for customers, a good day for the server ecosystem, and I'm excited to see AMD help drive the next phase in the evolution of the ARM server market. The pace of innovation continues to accelerate industry-wide, and it's going to be an exciting rest of the decade. From TorrentFreak.com, by Ernesto, dated October 31st, 2012, Six Strikes Evidence Re-Reviewed to Fix RIAA Lobbying Controversy. Starting next month, the file-sharing habits of millions of BitTorrent users in the United States will be monitored as part of an agreement between the MPAA, RIAA, and five major ISPs. The parties launched the Center for Copyright Information last year, which will be responsible for the implementation of the plan. To guarantee the accuracy of the evidence behind the copyright infringement accusations, the parties agreed to hire an impartial and independent technology expert. However, their commitment to this promise was questioned last week when the expert turned out to be Strauss Friedberg, a former RIAA lobbying group. The CCI is clearly well aware of the sensitivities generated by this particularly unfortunate pick. Quote, recent reports that a former employee of Strauss Friedberg lobbied several years ago on behalf of RIAA matters unrelated to CCI have raised questions about the impartiality of Strauss Friedberg, unquote, CCI's executive director Jill Lesser now states. The CCI is convinced that despite this history, Strauss Friedberg is capable of delivering an independent review. However, to reassure the public that it was carried out properly, CCI will hire a new expert to go over the evidence review. To read the rest of this article, follow the links in the show notes. From EFF.org, dated November 2, 2012, by Corinne McSherry and Marcia Hoffman, the 2012 DMCA rulemaking, what we got, what we didn't, and how to improve the process next time. Last week, the Liberian Congress issued his final decision limiting copyright owners' ability to sue you for making full use of the works you buy. The short version, it's a mixed bag. On one hand, the librarian looked to the future, broadening existing exemptions from extracting clips from DVDs to include clips from movies distributed online as well. At the same time, the librarian refused to expand an exemption for jailbreaking smartphones to include the smartphone's cousin, the tablet, even though there is little practical difference between the two devices. Equally illogically, the librarian refused to grant an exemption for jailbreaking video game consoles. Now the long version. In case you haven't been following the triennial process, here's some background. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act prohibits circumventing digital rights management and other technological measures used to protect copyrighted works. While this ban was meant to deter copyright infringement, the law is misused to chill innovation, free speech, and fair use. The one ray of light, every 3 years, the U.S. Copyright Office convenes a rulemaking to consider granting exemptions to the DMCA's ban on circumvention to mitigate the harms the law has caused to legitimate non-infringing uses of copyright materials. The Copyright Office pores over exemption proposals submitted by the public, weighs the pros and cons, and then offers recommendations to the Librarian of Congress, who ultimately grants or denies the exemptions. In the 2012 rulemaking, EFF asked the librarian to protect the jailbreaking of smartphones, electronic tablets, and video game consoles, liberating them to run operating systems and applications from any source, not just those approved by the manufacturer. EFF also asked for legal protections for artists and critics who use excerpts from DVDs or downloading services to create new remixed works. Our goal was to build on and expand exemptions that EFF won in the 2009 rulemaking proceeding for jailbreakers and remix artists. Other groups similarly sought to build on exemptions for educational uses, filmmaking, and multimedia ebooks. Hundreds of pages of materials for and against these exemptions were submitted to the Copyright Office, including a petition with more than 27,000 signatures in support of the proposed jailbreaking exemptions. Then this past summer, witnesses gathered on several days of hearings on both coasts. The office heard from industry representatives and proponents, of course, but equally, if not more important, was the testimony from users who would be directly affected, such as Vitter's Jonathan McIntosh and Tisha Turk and software developer Brad Lassie from Mozilla. Until 2009, the only people out to circumvent DVD encryption for fair use purposes were film and media studies professors. In 2009, that category was expanded to include all college and university professors, film and media studies students, documentary filmmakers, and non-commercial vitters. Now the librarian has expanded further, covering K-12 educators, all college students, multimedia ebook authors, and professionals who have been commissioned to make videos for non-profit purposes. The new exemption also permits breaking encryption on online content, not just DVDs. That's a big win for fair use creativity, and we are proud to have helped make it happen. To read the rest of the section on video exemptions, follow the links in the show notes. Later on in the article, under jailbreaking exemptions, in 2009, EFF won an exemption allowing users to modify smartphones so that they could install independent software not necessarily authorized by the phone's manufacturer, carrier, or platform provider, a process known as jailbreaking for iPhones and rooting for Android phones. This time, we asked the librarian not only to review this exemption, but expand it to cover tablets. This shouldn't have been a hard sell. In all important respects, tablets are simply larger mobile devices, right down to using the same access controls to restrict the programs users can install. They just aren't marketed as phones, even though they can also be used to make calls. The good news is that the librarian renewed EFF's exemption request for smartphones, relying on the Copyright Office's finding that jailbreaking is fair use. The Copyright Office noted in particular that the 2009 exemption hasn't harmed the market for smartphones, and the renewal may even make smartphones more attractive to consumers. Score one for the jailbreakers. Unfortunately, as with the video exemptions, this carve-out applies only to tool users, not tool makers. That means you can rely on this exemption to jailbreak your phone, but not to distribute jailbreaking code to others. The bad news is that the librarian refused to extend the exemption to tablets, claiming it was too hard to know which devices fall within this category. This is disappointing because the access controls on tablets and smartphones raise identical problems for consumers, and there is no reason why users should face DMCA liability for jailbreaking one but not the other, especially as the functionality of these devices continues to blur. EFF separately asked that an exemption be granted for users to jailbreak video game consoles so that academic researchers and independent homebrew developers can take full advantage of their console's potential without risk of DMCA liability. The librarian denied this exemption after the Copyright Office expressed concern that jailbreaking, even for legitimate uses, would lead to more infringing activity. The office was wrong, both on reasoning and policy. People who want to play infringing games aren't going to be intimidated by the little additional DMCA liability. Absent an exemption, the only people hindered by the DMCA threat are legitimate users like researchers and independent software developers. More generally, if you buy a device, whether it's a phone, a video game console, a tablet, or an ebook reader, it's yours, and you should be able to run any software you like on it. There's no principled reason to allow users this freedom on some devices but not others. We hope that in the future rulemakings, the librarian will recognize this fact. To read the rest of this article, follow the links in the show notes. From EFF.org, dated October 31, 2012, by Cindy Cohn and Julie Samuels, Mega Upload and the Government's Attack on Cloud Computing. Yesterday, EFF, on behalf of its client, Kyle Goodwin, filed a brief proposing a process for the court in the Mega Upload case to hold the government accountable for the actions it took and failed to take when it shut down Mega Upload's service and denied third parties like Mr. Goodwin access to their property, the government also filed a brief of its own, calling for a long, drawn-out process that would require third parties, often individuals or small companies, to travel to courts far away and engage in multiple hearings just to get their own property back. Even worse, the government admitted that it has accessed Mr. Goodwin's mega upload account and reviewed the content of his files. By doing so, the government has taken a significant and frightening step. It apparently searched through the data it seized for one purpose when its target was mega upload in order to use it against Mr. Goodwin, someone who was hurt by its actions, but who was plainly not the target of any criminal investigation, much less one against mega upload. This is, of course, a bold attempt to shift the focus to Mr. Goodwin, trying to distract both the press and the court from the government's failure to take any steps, much less the reasonable steps required by law, to protect property rights of third parties either before a warrant was executed or afterward. And of course, if the government is so well positioned that it can search through Mr. Goodwin's files and opine on their content, and it is not at all clear that this second search was authorized, presumably, it can also find a way to return them. But in addition, the government's approach should terrify any user of cloud computer services, not to mention the providers. The government maintains that Mr. Goodwin lost his property rights in his data by storing it on a cloud computing service. Specifically, the government argues that both the contract between Mega Upload and Mr. Goodwin, a standard cloud computing contract, and the contract between Mega Upload and the server host, Carpathia, also a standard agreement, likely limit any property interest he may have in his data. Reference page 4. If the government is right, no provider can both protect itself against sudden losses like those due to a hurricane and also promise its customers that their property rights will be maintained when they use the service, nor can they promise that their property might not suddenly disappear with no reasonable way to get it back if the government comes in with a warrant. Apparently, your property rights become severely limited if you allow someone else to host your data under standard cloud computing arrangements. This argument isn't limited in any way to Mega Upload. It would apply if the third-party host was Amazon's S3 or Google Apps or Apple iCloud. The government's tactics here demonstrate another chilling thing. If users do try to get their property back, the government won't hesitate to comb through their property to try to find an argument to use against them. The government also seeks to place a virtually insurmountable practical burden on users by asking the court to do a slow-walking, multi-step process that takes place in a far-away court. Most third parties who use cloud computing services to store their business records or personal information are not in a position to attend even one court appearance in Virginia, much less the multiple ones the government envisions in its submission to the court. Ultimately, if the government doesn't feel any obligation to respect the rights of Mega Upload's customers, and it clearly doesn't, it's not going to suddenly feel differently if the target of its next investigation is a more mainstream service. The scope of its seizure here was breathtaking, and they took no steps to engage in what the law calls minimization, either before its searches and seizures or afterwards, by taking steps to return property to cloud computing users who it knew would be hurt. And now the government is trying to use standard contractual language to argue that any user of a cloud computing service has, at best, severely limited ownership rights in their property. Those who have been watching on the sidelines thinking that the issue, in this case, are just about Mega Upload, should take heed. Other headlines in the news. To read these stories, follow links in the show notes. PS3 hacked again. LV0 keys leaked. CFW released, security hole reportedly unpatchable. The Internet Radio Fairness Act, what it is, why it's needed. News from thestand.org, perspectives.mvdorona.com, and allgov.com, used under arranged permission. News from torrentfreak.com and EFF.org, used under permission of the Creative Commons by Attribution license. News from VenezuelaAnalysis.com and DemocracyNow.org, used under permission of the Creative Commons by Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. News sources retain their respective copyrights. Thank you for listening to this episode of Talk Geek to Me. Here are the vital statistics for this program. Your feedback matters to me. Please send your comments to dg@deepgeek.us. The webpage for this program is at www.talkgeektome.us. You can subscribe to me on Identica as the username DeepGeek, or you could follow me on Twitter. My username there is DGTGTM, as in Deep Geek, Talk Geek to Me. This episode of Talk Geek to Me is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 Unported license. This license allows commercial reuse of the work, as well as allowing you to modify the work, so long as you share alike the same rights you have received under this license. Thank you for listening to this episode of Talk Geek to Me.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.